This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, the Pentagon plans to offer more jobs to Iraqis and a Texas town tries to live down its racist past. Joining us from our New York bureau is E.R. Shipp, professor in journalism at Hofstra University School of Communication. She's there along with John McWhorter, Manhattan Institute senior fellow in public policy. And in Nashville, Tennessee at Spotland Productions, Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle. So, folks, let's start with the issue of jobs for peace. That could be the upshot of a new Pentagon plan for Iraq. So members of a small task force have spent 6 months traveling around dangerous areas, and their mission is to restore nearly 200 state-owned factories abandoned after the U.S. invasion of 2003. Now, that could provide jobs to tens of thousands of Iraqis in the coming months.
If they
John,
live.
Well, paying attention to the need of the average Iraqi, the need for butter and bread, if you want to put it that way, help end the violence?
Well, I think this is terrible.
I'm going to ask
important.
ER that question. ER, what do you think?
I thought you said John. I'm sorry for...
That's okay. We can. We look alike. No, it's an interesting idea because the supposition here is that if people had a means of taking care of themselves and their families, they would not be prone necessarily to taking aid from the people behind the bombs. But the problem here is that you have to raise a question: can people stay alive long enough to get these jobs that the United States wants to create? Just yesterday, 70 people, most of whom were standing in line to get day work, were killed. A day or two before that, 50-something people. And along with the people killed, of course, are hundreds who are injured. But these are people who are looking for work. How is the U.S. new policy going to keep them alive long enough to even get these jobs?
John, sorry for cutting you off. I had a momentary technical glitch where I couldn't hear you. So
what do you think? Okay. I think that this is a really important idea because unemployment and joblessness, although it sounds like almost a rather mundane or diagonally related issue in terms of what's going on there, is actually very important. The taking away the work from Sunni career military men in particular was a serious mistake in Iraq because that's what they did. And once they didn't have jobs, well, big surprise that they might be more prone to joining movements, even movements that don't necessarily make coherent sense or have any true future trajectory. Or under Saddam, one of the problems was that having a kind of an Ozzie and Harriet middle class existence, having a kind of an upward mobility, was almost impossible for a lot of people, Sunni or Shiite. And that is the sort of thing that makes you more likely to join fanatic movements because you really have nothing else to do, nothing else to look for, just like the young black men from the streets that we're familiar with here who talk about how they never had any opportunity and nobody was ever interested in teaching them how to do something. So the idea of giving these people something as simple as work is one of the freshest things I've heard from Iraq in a very long time.
Jeff, we just heard a report from independent journalist Brian Palmer, or a discussion with him, and there are a lot of issues around violence. There is the issue of sectarian violence between Iraqis. There's the issue of people who were accidentally killed by U.S. troops, which is what we were just talking about. And there's so many issues on the table. How much do you think ER's point about people not even being safe waiting to line up for jobs is going to factor into this?
I think it's going to factor into it. I think that both things are important. One, you have to have the safety to feel like you can even go to work in the first place, and you have to have a physical body to actually perform the task. So I think that safety and security is a critical concern. Also, though, to kind of piggyback on something John said, as an African-American male in America, I'd love to see such an initiative to put some of our people to work here. This kind of post-Baker Commission consideration of some solid alternatives to sending more troops is pretty amazing that you can have these kind of ideas and along with the other 79 that come out of a few meetings and discussions that couldn't have taken place before we invaded a country, but at least now people are thinking outside the box. One, there are a couple of questions here. One, whoever said, if you build it, they will come. obviously was stuck in a film dream, and they've never been involved in actual institution building. What's the sustainability of some of these factories? That would be my concern. Unless some of the companies like Caterpillar and Dow, two companies that have stepped forward to support this Defense Department's initiatives already, unless they step up and make long-term commitments to economic support and development, then this is going to be a flash in the pan. Because if you think blanket unemployment is bad and it hurts people now, try giving them jobs for a short amount of time and then pulling out and not offering that support for the long term. That causes even more devastation. And the other question is going to be, is this going to create another nation of underpaid workers that's going to end up being cheap labor for U.S. companies? Because if that is what spreading freedom is going to be all about, and that ends up happening, then I think more problems will have been created than solved.
I agree with you on that one, Jeff. I noticed that the chairman of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce said something that sounds good, and I'll try to quote it here. I can't look at this solely as a business proposition. I've already got suppliers. I'm doing this because I think there's a social responsibility, not only to Iraq, to the Iraqi people, but to our troops. End of his quote. This is Gerald Shaheen. If that is indeed the way business will step up to the plate, we should hope and maybe even demand that they live up to what they seem to be promising, that this would not be a source of cheap labor. This would not just be a charitable activity, that the suppliers that they hire will actually need the materials that are being created by the Iraqi population.
We know U.S. corporate culture is all about social responsibility. I
politely differ. We have to assume that this will be a transitional stage where they will indeed be working for American entities and that there will be a certain advantage taken, because that's really the best that we can do at this point in terms of making them innovative and creating something that Iraq can give the world at its own high prices. Obviously, that can't start yet. But having these people having work and calming the country down is obviously the urgent priority for now, even if there is going to be some echo of a sweatshop model.
All right. Well, I just want to remind everybody, if you're tuning in, I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes, and we've got E.R. Shipp, professor in journalism at Hofstra University, John McWhorter of the Manhattan Institute, and Jeff Obafemi-Carr in Nashville, host of the radio show Freestyle. Now we're moving on to Vidor, Texas, a little bit closer to home. About 40 or 50 years ago, it was a sundown town, which to black folks meant you couldn't be out there after dark. And today, the town is making kind of a PR push to say the past is the past, you know, black folks are welcome. But a CNN report offered the perspective of Walter Diggles. He lives outside of Vidor and says African Americans still don't want to be there after dark.
They think that that's a racist town, and when you go through Vidor, you better be very careful. And most blacks still refuse to stop.
That same CNN report got a Vidor native to comment on what she thinks of African Americans.
I don't mind being friends with them, you know, talking and stuff like that, but as far as mingling and eating with them and all that kind of stuff, I mean, that's where I draw the line.
So, Jeff, you can be my friend, but you can't eat with me and you can't mingle with me. So the holiday invitation is off.
If I said that exact same quote without naming race, y'all would never let me back on the show again. So, now, it's really interesting because, I've just written, my latest play is called Ordinary Heroes, and it's about the civil rights movement in Nashville. It premieres in February, and I'd spent 2 years talking to people about race, and it's very interesting because you come across a lot of those quotes where people actually say, well, I didn't see anything wrong with black people. I just would never let them in my house. It's just that kind of thing. But I mean, as far as anything else, I work, you know, around them, and I ride the bus and I walk by. I mean, it's amazing. And I used to travel even a couple of years ago, flashing forward through a little stretch of L.A. Now, I have to clarify that in the South, L.A. means Lower Alabama. So there are
still, lovely Atlanta.
Or lovely Atlanta. But down in Lower Alabama, there's still a string of towns where you know to make sure that you have a full tank of gas, a solid knowledge of state routes and highways, and a solid MapQuest. You have a very empty, exactly, because in some of those places, there are very few cell phone towers, and stops are few and far between. And people say people will tell you, especially elderly black people, look, if you got to travel from this point, make sure you have these things in place. And it's kind of sad that even in 1993 in Vidor, Texas, the Klan marched to keep blacks out of the projects. Now, what does that say about a town when in America, people will march to keep us out of public housing? So I think that the modern PR push alone is not necessarily enough. There has to be some kind of initiative where African Americans feel comfortable. And when you put on CNN that kind of mentality, then the folklore goes out that, hey, things have not changed much.
ER, we have later in the show, we're going to have an interview with Joyce King, who has a book, Forgotten Hurricane. And she goes through the South as a black woman interviewing people in some of these, no doubt, sundown towns. She spent a lot of time in Vidor and Jasper. I had similar experiences when I was reporting one of my books, just going through. I went to cover a racial incident in southern Georgia, and I was in a town where I probably, you know, common sense says I shouldn't have been. As a journalist, you know, as a black journalist, can you avoid, I mean, isn't it part of your mission to go to places like that and in some way take some risks? But what about folks who are not there on a work-related mission? I mean, do we have an go ahead.
When you're a journalist, you generally have some kind of backup, so you're not actually out there on your own. But I have been to places, not only in the South. I actually messed up a Klan rally. They were marching in Marietta, Georgia, and I marched with them. And none of the guys wanted to be seen with me because I had my tape recorder and I knew I had a photographer near me too. So I had a little bit of backup. But you can take these audacious moves. I've been to a place called Louisville, Nebraska, where white people literally ran away from me when I was trying to approach them to do a story. But this is not just a Southern issue.
No.
Northern places exist. We know that, you know, a number of black people in the last two decades, we can think of prominent cases in New York, where black folks were in the wrong part of town in New York City after dark. So it's an issue that's out there. I praise those people who on their own and by themselves take the initiative to fight for these causes. But I don't know what we can do beyond talking about it to get people like this woman we heard from to say she'd be willing to work with them but not mingle with them. I don't know what that means. And I don't know what eating food with them would have to do with her take on race either.
Nothing gives you an upset stomach like having a meal with black folks. That's the message.
I guess, you know, but I had a guy once, I'll shut up so the other guys can talk here, but a guy who volunteered his time to go to a senior citizen center in Dawson, Georgia, would cut the hair of the elderly men. And I asked him about letting black guys come into his barbershop. And he said no, because he didn't know how to cut their hair. I said, but you're cutting the hair of black people in the senior center. He said, but they don't know what it looks like.
Oh, wow.
Well, John, you know, following up on what ER said, it's not just in the South. One of the, you know, some of the toughest struggles over integration of public housing have been in the North. I mean, I think of, you know, Boston.
Chicago.
Yeah. So what at this point, I mean, when you have kind of free-floating racism, not necessarily part of any class action suit or corporate issue or governmental issue, but just free-floating racism, what do you do?
Well, you know, to be honest, Farai, I mean, everything that's been said about this is obviously true, and it is there. And I think that we've seen that you can take away legislated racism. You can even take away the legality of openly expressed racism. But in terms of a complete transformation of people's underlying biases and attitudes, I don't think that psychological or sociological science has a way of doing that at this point. And so these conversations certainly should be had. We should know that there are Vidor, Texases. I don't know, maybe it's just me, but when I see something like that, I think to myself that if it were even 1967, you wouldn't have had to go to Vidor, Texas and seek out these places and call attention to them on Paula Zahn. You could have gone to any neighborhood in Philadelphia except roughly Mount Airy and Germantown and found the exact same thing. All over the country, I see change. But the truth is, I'm not sure how much one can do about it. It comes down to just a simple illustration. I happened to be on the CNN special last night, and so I saw all of the story on Vidor. And if you could have seen seen, and I hate to put it this way, but if you could have seen the woman who we're now only hearing on audio talking about how she doesn't want to mingle, I think the first thought of anybody who is psychologically healthy and black would be that I really wouldn't want to eat with her either. And increasingly, the kind of person who says that kind of thing openly has no purchase upon the levers of power in our society. And so for me, I'm more concerned with other things than what the Zahn special called hidden racism.
Maybe they're kids.
Maybe that's just me. And the special could not help but show that among children, it is increasingly hard to find these sorts of statements.
Well, I guess what I would say to you, Jeff, is isn't that in and of itself part of the issue that traditionally poorer white Americans have expressed more clearly animus towards black Americans? Doesn't mean that racism doesn't flow across all class levels, but people who are going to say it on tape may have.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and there's this kind of a teacher of mine once said, likes don't like likes. You know, people who were having to fight their way through society can sometimes be at each other's throats.
They can. And the poor often are manipulated from the top down to think that the reason why they are poor is because of the other minorities, immigrants, everybody else who's coming over stealing their jobs, everybody who's, and these are the people who are fueled by this national debate on everything from affirmative action to discrimination. And that's why racism is about pure ignorance. And that's why people will stand up and say things like that, because they just don't know any better. But I think it's a very valid point to bring out that a lot of the young people today and a lot of their youth are not thinking in the same vein. And it's getting harder and harder to control that amongst the young population because they're mixing, because of the influence
exactly.
of culture, including hip-hop culture, including the pervasiveness of that
exactly.
hip-hop culture. Now, these kids from rural parts of not only metropolitan cities but southern cities are now mingling at the mall. They're hanging yep. out at school. They're fascinated
and they're
by our
culture. Scandalizing their parents sometimes. We're gonna have to leave it there.
Exactly. Yeah.
Jeff Obafemi Carrs, host of the radio show Freestyle, John McWhorter, Manhattan Institute Senior Fellow in Public Policy, E.R. Shipp, Professor in Journalism at Hofstra University School of Communication. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for riding.